The following is For Your Ears Only. I'm David Alpern.
I'm Melissa Axelworth, and we have newsmakers, experts, and top reporters to bring you these stories.
Term 2 defense. Obama tries moving past the IRS Benghazi and free press controversy, but criticism continues in Congress and at a speech of his own.
After the tornado, who pays? A new study says taxpayers cover more than insurance companies and argues for more government action on climate change.
After action, still serving. In the week of Memorial Day, we profile a nonprofit that helps veterans help their communities. It's called The Mission Continues.
After midnight, actor-director Billy Hayes on how his Turkish drug case became a book, Midnight Express, an Oscar-winning film, and now an opera and a cause.
Cinderella Reenchanted, the magical Rodgers and Hammerstein musical, is up for a Tony Award as Best Revival, though it never actually played before on Broadway.
Plus notable quotes from last week's news.
All that and more for your ears only. Now a project of the nonprofit New York Foundation for the Arts. For your ears only for the week of May 26th and Memorial Day, I'm David Alpern.
I'm Melissa Axelworth.
Basically stonewall the committee. That cannot continue. We know where that will lead. It will lead to a special prosecutor. It will lead to special counsel being appointed to get to the bottom of this. So I hope that's not the approach of the IRS going forward, because there will be hell to pay.
Any U.S. military action in foreign lands risks creating more enemies and impacts public opinion overseas. Moreover, our laws constrain the power of the president.
I love my country.
You know, I think that and I'm going off script as you might expect here.
No wonder the White House wanted to change the conversation last week from defense of its own image to defense of the nation. But contention continued over a swarm of second-term distractions. After a repeated Fifth Amendment response by the IRS official in charge of controversial special scrutiny given conservative groups seeking tax-exempt status, even House Democrat Stephen Lynch was furious. Lois Lerner was quickly placed on administrative leave, but she might yet be called back and held in contempt of Congress. And a special counsel still might be named, with all the uncertainty that kind of investigation can unleash.
President Obama faced more personal fury when an anti-war activist repeatedly interrupted the address meant to reframe America's response to the evolving threat of terrorism. The president suggested new restraint in the use of drone strikes and another push to close the Center for Terror War Detainees at Guantanamo, both of which helped create new Islamist enemies. Some other critics say the president had gone too far, others not far enough. To talk about all those developments and more, we're joined again by Princeton Professor of History and Public Affairs Julian Zelizer. His books include Arsenal of Democracy, On National Security Issues, the biography Jimmy Carter, and Governing America. Welcome back.
Thanks for having me.
Let's start with the president's speech and his promise to address Guantanamo, where detainees on hunger strike are now being force-fed and many have been cleared for release. Obama said repatriation of some to Yemen would now be considered and that he would press to move the rest to a mainland facility. But how much do you see really changing?
Well, it's hard to know. We heard this before when he came into office and essentially moved forward with his promise to close Guantanamo. But the devil is in the details. And as the details of the move emerged, there was a lot of political backlash. And in the end, he didn't do anything. So my guess is there'll be some moves. There'll be a move to diminish the number of people there. But I'm not convinced that you're going to see a shutdown of this facility, which will clearly frustrate many liberals and many of his supporters.
For the people who remain in detention, I wonder if a different location is going to make being force-fed any more pleasant. Obama said we must call an end to the war on terror, though without much detail on how our actual anti-terrorist tactics will really change, especially drone strikes, declining at the moment, and which he admitted were not always wise or moral, yet he pointed out the problems of any additional oversight. So what changed there?
Rhetoric so far. You know, thus far, this president has embraced much of the homeland security tactics of his predecessor, despite running against them. And in some areas, like the use of drones, he's become more aggressive, not less aggressive. So while this speech is interesting, and it could be significant, with some vague promise of moving more toward the rule of law, at this point, at least from the speech, it's hard to see, you know, where the big changes are going to come. And I think we have to assume at this point, until we see a change, that we're still living within the same set of policies.
Let's talk about Obama's challenges at home. Do you think a special counsel might be a reasonable way to settle the IRS issue, maybe set the stage for tax code reform that more clearly defines when political groups like the Tea Party can obtain tax-exempt status?
Well, I'm not sure a special counsel will lead to reform. It's obviously one solution, but it's going to focus more on the question of who did what and when. I think if reform is serious, you know, we could talk about loophole closing tax reform. We could talk about tax reform for these organizations that are political, not educational. We could talk even about structural reforms to the IRS to make sure that this doesn't happen again in the branches. I'm not sure the special counsel, which will become very politicized quickly, would address any of this.
Republicans have focused on how much was known about the IRS Tea Party scrutiny before the last election, suggesting a cover-up or at least bureaucratic foot-dragging through that critical period. Does that follow a pattern leading to many scandals in other second terms? That is, last-minute scandals of the first term are kind of dragged along and don't emerge until after re-election?
Well, sure, that's true. You know, there's always potential for scandal in any administration, and often there are these stories lingering at the end of the first term that just don't quite make it. And what you see then are parties, inevitably the opposition party, claiming there is a cover-up, there is an attempt to quash that October surprise. And so this is to be expected. But again, I think the more we focus on that kind of question, the less we're going to actually deal with the issues that might be very real that need to be addressed.
Obama's biggest second-term problem seems to be the disappointment of supporters that he hasn't achieved the systemic changes he promised and basically seemed to embody. But you note he's hardly the first president in that fix. Talk about the limiting factors to keep in mind.
Look, Jimmy Carter came into office promising everyone he would reform government, telling voters to trust him. By 1980, he seemed quite ordinary and to have accepted the status quo. You know, the first thing a president faces is intense opposition. And when you face intense opponents in Congress, you're less willing to take on reforms that might hurt your own party. And the second problem is that reform is not a high priority issue for most voters. While they hate government, they care more about bread and butter issues. So many presidents make the calculation, like Obama, why deal with campaign finance? Instead, I want to deal with the economy. And those issues go to the wayside.
You suggest that a real scandal can shake the system up. The way Watergate led to campaign finance reforms before, one has to say Obama himself helped to undermine them. But we saw how Congress resisted new gun safety legislation even after the, one could say, scandalous Newtown shooting. Has it become so polarized that the Congress is essentially scandal-proof?
Well, reform is always possible, and it really depends on how grand the scandal is. I don't think anything we're dealing with right now is enough to make politicians feel that if they don't change the status quo, they're going to lose their jobs. That's what Watergate did. That's what the mid-1970s felt like if you were in Washington, and that's why we underwent a huge number of reforms in that decade. So it's not too partisan. I think this is always possible, but it really does have to be quite a dramatic scandal to make legislators change the system they benefit from.
On the other hand, we're seeing what appears to be bipartisan progress on immigration reform, basically because some Republican leaders think their party needs better inroads to the growing Hispanic electorate. But there's still tension over the balance between more border security and some path to legal status for 11 million undocumented people currently here. What do you see happening in the more conservative House of Representatives?
You know, I still think there's a chance that enough Republicans in the House will go along with this. They, too, are feeling intense pressure from the National Party leaders to do something. The Senate has made some concessions on border security to make it tougher and placate them. And finally, some are saying that the IRS scandal and all the scandals of the past few weeks have taken attention away from immigration reform and in some ways improved the chances for the bill to pass because legislators just aren't as invested in fighting that battle. They're much more eager to focus on the story of the IRS.
Thank you. Princeton Professor of History and Public Affairs Julian Zelizer. His books include Arsenal of Democracy, the biography Jimmy Carter, and Governing America.
Quote from the news, "I apologize that women had to see this today, but in our lands, women have to see the same thing." That was the statement captured on a bystander's cell phone by one of two Londoners who hacked an English soldier to death in the street outside his base. The men claimed it was retaliation for attacks on Muslims around the world before rushing at police who shot and arrested them and two others believed to be involved.
Next, tornadoes and the cost of climate change. For your ears only. We're back for your ears only. I'm Melissa Axelberth.
I'm David Alpern with this quote from the news. He goes to get a cigarette or something, and then he goes off the deep end. That was one of the law enforcement officers who interviewed Ibrahim Todashev, a friend of Boston Marathon bombing suspect Tamerlan Tsarnaev, before he attacked one of them and was shot to death. Todashev reportedly had just admitted that he and Tsarnaev were involved in a Massachusetts murder on 9/11 of 2011 that might have led local authorities to monitor the subsequent bombing suspect more closely, but didn't. Now this.
It's certainly a very, very sad day for the state of Oklahoma, a very hard day, a tragic day of tremendous disaster that has hit this community of Moore and other areas of the state.
Storm chasers David Demko and Heidi Farrar captured the horrendous sights and sounds of the tornado that devastated the Moore, Oklahoma area last week that left 24 dead and nearly 400 injured. And Governor Mary Fallon later surveyed the destruction, as much as $2 billion in damages to 1,200 homes plus other properties. She said she would quickly sign legislation to tap $45 million from a state rainy day fund for emergency relief.
And if history is any judge, most of the damage will ultimately be covered by taxpayers in Oklahoma and around the country. A new report from the Natural Resources Defense Council says that federal spending on increasingly dramatic natural disasters, tornadoes, hurricanes, wildfires, floods, and droughts, reached nearly $100 billion last year, or about $1,100 per taxpayer. To talk more about the report, climate-related economic costs, and potential savings, for your ears only, we're joined by Lori Johnson, chief economist for the Climate and Clean Air Program at NRDC. Welcome to our program.
Thanks for having me, David.
How does federal spending on damages from natural disasters compare with what's paid out by the insurance companies?
Well, actually, we found, and we were surprised by this in our study, that basically a 3-to-1 ratio. We picked up most of the tab. And that trend actually started with Hurricane Katrina. The insurance industry got really, really hit then. So they've been backing out from this because it's a very high-risk area. We don't know what's going to be happening with climate. So insurers, you know, they make assessments based on risk, and there's more risk now. So they've been pulling out.
What part of all federal spending goes to those climate-related costs, and how does that compare with other major budget categories?
Yeah, we were actually very surprised to find this out. It's not a line item in the actual federal budget, but what we found was that we spent more on that than any other item in the non-defense discretionary part of the government's budget. So that's more than the federal government spends on transportation or on education. And basically, it's one out of six dollars in that budget.
There's a natural tendency of many survivors to take a defiant stance about rebuilding their properties and their lives just as before. But some critics say that government programs too often assist in recreating the same vulnerabilities, either in dangerous locations or without adequate precautions like mandatory storm shelters, even if they are costly. What's your view on that?
Well, these are personal decisions, but what we must decide as a nation is that we're going to stand up to climate change by reducing the industrial carbon pollution that's driving this chaos and threatening our future. And we can start. The biggest source to start with is carbon pollution coming from power plants. That's about 40% of our emissions.
And you have a program that says we can use the current Clean Air Act without having to rely on support from a Congress that may often and in many cases be dubious about carbon and climate change.
Yes, that's right. Actually, it was a bipartisan Congress in 1970 under Nixon that passed the Clean Air Act, which requires the president to actually reduce this carbon power plant pollution. So it's his authority, and we really hope that he will do it. So the Congress, actually, we know is not functioning very well, but the administration has both the authority and the legal obligation to do this. And we can do it with very high benefits at a very modest cost.
Well, in fact, the EPA already has proposed more carbon-conscious standards for new power plants. Where does your program focus?
Right now we're focused on the existing power plants. Natural gas is pretty much pushing coal out of the market in any case, but the biggest source of our pollution is the existing power plants, not the new ones that are being built. They are about 40%, as I said, of our emissions. So we're focusing on trying to get that that done first, because that's going to be our best reduction. And we can reduce that pollution by 26% by 2020 and by 34% by 2025. And we estimate that by 2020, it'll be a compliance cost of about $4 billion, but the benefits will be $25 to $60 billion in health and environmental benefits.
You propose a cooperative arrangement with individual states to choose the best compliance options for their own economies. Let's look at some of those options, beginning with existing plant cleanup or modification.
Sure. What we propose is that plants have a flexible mechanism, so they can choose how they're going to do this. Most importantly, the states will be treated differently, because some states are much more coal-intensive, so therefore they're more carbon-intensive, and others are more gas-intensive. So we need to recognize that that's going to be a different responsibility and burden between states in terms of how much they all reduce. So we propose a flexible mechanism that makes your emissions reduction requirement based upon in proportion to your energy mix.
There's also potential carbon saving in just shifting between kinds of plants.
Right. Coal-fired plants can, a utility can, you know, ramp up their production at a natural gas plant and lower it at its more polluting plant. So you can switch between units. You can also use energy efficiency programs that will count towards credit of reducing emissions. You could also develop clean energy, and that would count towards an emission unit reduction. You could also, if you want to, enter into other agreements with other states if you wanted to set up some sort of offsetting mechanisms there. So if you have a very, very carbon-intensive state that can do things more cheaply or more expensively, you can make the arrangements between states to do it the most effectively and cheaply.
And when it comes to us as individuals, we can help out with this as well. We can increase our efficiency of energy use.
Yeah, we can actually, every time we pass energy efficiency standards, billions of dollars are saved for consumers, and it creates a lot of jobs, because it's very energy, it's very job intensive to go and retrofit buildings and to basically do the kinds of things you need to do to improve your energy efficiency. So it's a great job creator, and it also saves consumers billions of dollars.
Another area in which individuals play a part is pollution from cars and trucks. What's the progress and the prospect there?
I see two things. One is we've made a lot of progress under the Obama administration. Fuel economy standards have been stagnant for decades, and they needed to be upgraded and revised, and they set record standards. So we're going to reduce our emissions by half by 2025 from new cars and trucks, and we'll get double the fuel economy, so we can go twice as far in a gallon of gasoline. So that's going to save billions of dollars at the gas pump. That's a big chunk of our carbon pollution. The second component with cars is we really need to ramp up even more our energy research funds for electric vehicles, because we need two things. We need to clean the electrification system, which is going to power the electric cars, but we also need to continue the research and development and the deployment and the mass production of electric cars so we can get both of those two things together.
Lori Johnson is chief economist for the Climate and Clean Air Program at the Natural Resources Defense Council.
A quote from the news, "I'm actually an atheist." That was Rebecca Witzman, a survivor of the Oklahoma tornado, after CNN's Wolf Blitzer prompted her to say she must feel like thanking God. But she graciously added, "I don't blame anyone for thanking the Lord."
Next, with Memorial Day in mind, the mission continues for Your Ears Only. We're back for Your Ears Only. I'm David Alpern.
I'm Melissa Axelberth with a quote from the news. "No circumstance will allow me to stay as president." That was Afghanistan's Hamid Karzai denying the many rumors that he will somehow sidestep his country's constitution and scheduled elections. Also last week, over 200 male Afghan students protested as anti-Islamic a decree on elimination of violence against women that would protect them from child marriages, forced marriages, and being charged as adulterers when they're raped. Now this.
The killing in Iraq continues to escalate, with more than 200 dead in bombings and other Sunni versus Shiite attacks in the past week, more than 700 in April, the highest monthly total in 5 years. The bloody toll mirrored a deepening ethnic civil war in neighboring Syria and threatened to spread that throughout the region.
Whether maintaining U.S. military operations in Iraq would have forestalled the violence or created more American victims of it is not readily apparent. But for many of those who served there and in Afghanistan, the mission continues as well, in a new civilian mode, serving their communities while helping themselves reintegrate into peacetime society. And in this week of Memorial Day, for Your Ears Only, we're pleased to spotlight a nonprofit group that's assisting in that process. The mission continues, and its president, former Army helicopter pilot Spencer Kimpton. Welcome to the program, sir.
It's my pleasure to be here, Melissa.
First, tell us a bit about yourself. Son of a military family, West Point valedictorian. Where and how long did you serve?
Well, I was very fortunate to have strong models of military service in my family. My grandfather earned a Silver Star in Korea. My grandmother was a Marine in World War II. My aunt and uncle were both officers in the Army Medical Corps, and my dad was a West Point graduate. So I served for 8 years as an Army aviator in the Republic of Korea, Bosnia-Herzegovina, and Central and South America.
And what were some of the jobs you did afterwards in civilian life?
Well, I transitioned out of the military to earn an MBA and then went into the business community. I was consulting at McKinsey & Company, a global management consulting firm. It's an amazing organization, but I struggled there to develop a deep connection to the mission, a mission that was ultimately defined by increasing profits for clients. So I started serving nonprofits and government clients in an attempt to get closer to what I'd call mission-driven work. And this ultimately introduced me to the education reform movement. And I left McKinsey to join the staff at Teach for America and was helping to recruit over 50,000 college graduates to apply to teach in low-income schools across the country.
When was the Mission Continues created, and what drew you to it?
Well, our founder, Eric Greitens, a Navy SEAL and a Rhodes Scholar, started the Mission Continues in 2007 after he returned from duty in Iraq and Afghanistan. And what compelled me about the Mission Continues is that we say that despite the very real challenges that veterans may face coming home, the most important thing we can do is to tell them we still need them. We operate from a fundamental belief that veterans need to feel connected to a mission when they come home, and that veterans can find that mission in serving their communities. So I had that same need in my own career, and that's why I came to the Mission Continues.
What kind of community service do you direct your Mission Continues fellows to, and with what kind of preparation?
Well, we believe that the most important criteria for service is that it speaks to the veteran's passion. So if they're passionate about mentoring children, we may direct them towards organizations like the Boys and Girls Clubs or Big Brothers Big Sisters. If they're passionate about helping those in crisis, we may direct them towards emergency response units or the American Red Cross. So our fellows have served across the entire spectrum of community issues. And once we've helped them identify an organization or a cause, we work with them to build relevant goals for their fellowship. And we also work with the organization to ensure that they are providing the fellows an engaged supervisor and a mentor, a good working environment, and clear direction.
How do their community service and their civilian lives continue after their fellowships end? And do they remain attached to your organization?
So we survey all of our fellows at the end of their fellowships and also several months after they've finished, and roughly 90% of them report that they're more likely to engage in public service in their lives because of their fellowship, and 90% of them have already volunteered since their fellowships ended. We also engage our alumni in a variety of ways, asking them to recruit other fellows or to participate or lead service projects across the country or just to represent their generation of veterans in media opportunities. And we're motivated by the fact that 97% of our alumni would recommend the fellowship to their veteran friends.
How many Mission Continues fellows are there at any one time, and how many have passed through the program since its inception?
So we've awarded nearly 700 fellowships since 2007, and we award roughly 75 new fellowships each quarter. So in early May, we brought in our newest class of fellows at a three-day orientation weekend here in New York City. And we gathered them here from 26 different states and conducted a large service project at a school for children with developmental and psychiatric disabilities here in Brooklyn. And afterwards, the entire class went to the 9/11 memorial site and publicly took a new oath to serve their communities while standing in front of the footprint of the North Tower. It was a moving experience for the fellows, all of whom had served in the military since the attacks on 9/11.
With all the evidence of post-traumatic stress disorder and even suicide among service members and veterans, we have to ask what your program's experience is with these problems and what assistance you can provide.
So our experience has shown us that what many veterans need most upon returning home is to find their next mission and their new team and a chance to feel valuable again. So isolation and a lack of sense of purpose can lead to issues with substance abuse or self-medication, relationship troubles, or even thoughts of suicide. So we're addressing what we believe is a root cause, this loss of purpose. Many of our staff are veterans, and many were themselves alumni of our program, so we do rely upon shared experience and peer-to-peer support, but we also rely upon strong nonprofit and government partners to assist us with specific behavioral or mental health issues that our fellows may face.
Former Army helicopter pilot Spencer Kimpton is president of The Mission Continues, online at missioncontinues.org.
Quote from the news, that's not justice, that's revenge. That was murder convict Jodi Arias in an interview on NBC's Today Show, reversing her prior claim that she would rather die than serve life in prison. But the jury declared itself hung on the sentence, and new penalty proceedings will be held.
Next, Midnight Express on track again, for your ears only. We're back for your ears only. I'm Melissa Exelberth.
I'm David Alpern with this quote from the news. The Irish subsidiary had nothing to do with creating those crown jewels. It has no employees. It has no offices. That was Michigan Senator Carl Levin dismissing the testimony of Apple chief executive Tim Cook that the tech giant was not violating American tax laws by cycling billions of dollars through a company in Ireland. Elsewhere in Europe last week, many countries were reforming domestic laws so that their banks could not be used as secret tax havens. Quote, bank secrecy is a relic of the past, said European Union senior official Algirdas Semeta. Now this.
He was a 20-year-old American boy, up against a system he didn't understand, spoken in a language he couldn't speak. He was beyond the help of his parents and the power of the United States government. And yet, he triumphed.
As anyone who's seen it knows, Midnight Express is a film that's not easy to forget. The images, based on a real-life memoir by young student Billy Hayes, his arrest on drug charges, sentenced to 30 years in a dank Turkish prison, subsequent mental breakdown there, and ultimate escape, sent shivers down the spines of an entire drug-disposed generation.
That was 1978. Now, 35 years later, Midnight Express is back as a ballet that opened last month at the London Coliseum. In a republished edition of Hayes' original 1977 book, and a new volume titled The Midnight Express Letters, notes he wrote while in prison, both from CBP Press. The challenge of drugs and drug penalties also has remained a key issue for author, actor, director Hayes, and for your ears only, he joins us now. Billy Hayes, welcome to the program.
Thank you so much for having me.
You wrote the book Midnight Express in 1977. How did it end up on the big screen?
Before the book was even finished, I had an early galley done. A producer from California, Peter Guber, contacted my literary agent in New York and flew me out to California to talk about a movie, which 6 months ago I was in prison eating beans, and now I've got a book being finished, and they're flying me to California to talk about a film. A very strange transition into life.
Well, Midnight Express won Academy Awards, positive reviews from 95% of critics, and became one of those cautionary tales people watched over and over and over again. But how faithful to the true story was it? For example, the scene in which your character pushes a guard, accidentally killing him, which enables your escape. Did it really happen like that?
Did not happen. Actually, the film is, I say emotionally, the film is pretty accurate. Factually, they made some changes. One of the big changes was the escape itself. which was sort of made for Hollywood. I escaped off an island in a rowboat in a storm and ran through Turkey for 3 days. Made for Hollywood. I thought at the very least if they put that in there, people would say, good film except for that made-up ending. They didn't even use it. They substituted pushing the guard and having him hit his head on the spike and then skipping out the door. I did not kill that guard. He was killed by a fellow prisoner. This was a very brutal, saddest kind of guard. Both guards are just guys doing a job. But I saw the film, and Alan Parker said, Billy, what 45 minutes of the movie do you want to cut out to put in your real escape? The audience has had enough. Let's get them out of the bloody theaters. And he's probably correct in that aspect.
Almost all of the reviews were positive, but there were some who weren't happy about the portrayal of Turks in the movie, including you. Tell us about that.
It's my biggest problem with Midnight Express, the movie, is that you don't see any good Turks, and it creates this overall impression that all Turks are terrible, and this is a horrible country, and you should never go to Istanbul, none of which is true, obviously. I loved Istanbul. I spent a lot of time there prior to getting arrested, and I made Turkish friends and so on. You wouldn't like the prison, and I didn't like the legal system, and you won't like the guards. But that's true of any country you get arrested in. The bottom line for me is you don't see any good Turks. It creates an overall impression that's very detrimental to Turkey. Their tourism dropped 95% when the movie came out, and that's just not fair or valid to them or to my own experience.
Have you ever gone back to Turkey? Could you? Would you?
Strangely enough, I did. I went back about 5 years ago at the request of the Turkish National Police.
Wow.
They'd heard me speaking over the years. For 30 years, I've said what I just said, that I wish they'd shown good Turks, and not all Turks are like that. But my little voice against those incredible, powerful images on the screen, because Alan Parker made an amazing movie, and Brad Davis put his heart and soul into it, and film is such a powerful medium, that's all people knew about Turkey, and that's not good or fair or valid to them. So I've been saying that. Some Turkish policemen saw me on YouTube somewhere talking about that issue, and they were having a big conference in Istanbul with international police from all over the world talking about peace and global security, and the world press was going to be focused there. So they contacted me and said, we'd love to have you come back and say what you said.
Talking about scenes in the film, there are a number of them that no matter how much time has passed, you just can't unsee. There's one that really freaks me out, actually. It's the one in the ward for the insane where you and other prisoners walk catatonically around a pillar all day long. Is that something that you flash back on?
That scene is very accurate, strangely enough, because it was the most bizarre place I've ever been in my life. You don't appreciate what you have till you lose it. I certainly didn't. I took everything in America that was good for granted, protested everything else till I lost it all in an instant. I didn't even appreciate the Istanbul prison that I was in until I lost that and went to the madhouse. That was the bottom of the birdcage. That was the most bizarre place I've ever been in my life. Turkey has since closed that section, Section 13 for the criminally insane. Many years ago, they closed it, which is a credit to them. But at the time, it was pretty insane. I went there trying to get a crazy report because they can't keep you in jail if you're judged to be legally crazy. Of course, you're that crazy, they don't let you on the street. But they keep you in the madhouse, which I'd heard from prison scuttlebutt was a better place to escape from, which is all I was thinking about for the first few years.
Well, as we've said, you've become an author. I mean, you are an author. You've become a filmmaker yourself. How did the story become a ballet in London, and how was it received?
Wow, is that strange. Yes, the director, Peter Schalfus, had read Midnight Express back in 1979 and always wanted to do a version of it. He does sort of pop ballets. He's done one on the Rolling Stones. He's done one on Elvis. He's trying to expand the world of ballet. I mean, how many times can you do Swan Lake? So among the many topics he wanted to do was Midnight Express. And he ended up calling me. My wife and I were able to go over there about a month ago, and they put together a week's performance at the London Coliseum, this huge 2,500-seat, brilliant old English opera house, and they did the ballet on the stage, and it was incredibly powerful and so moving. And ballet is such an expressive form anyway, and I have a dramatic story, and they were able to express it so well. It really moved me. There was a scene, actually, where I had my dad, who came to visit me in prison, and they had him on the stage dancing, and it just, wow. Yeah, amazing experience.
Writer, actor, director Billy Hayes is author of Midnight Express, now republished by CBP, along with the Midnight Express letters, available on Amazon and Kindle.
Quote from the news, it will be left behind. That was former California Boy Scout leader David Rice on scouting's fate if it did not concede cultural changes and permit openly gay members, which it did by a narrow vote last week, but not gay leaders. Many defections from scouting on moral grounds were threatened.
Next, that glass slipper back on Broadway for the first time, for viewers only.
A last chorus for your ears only. I'm David Alpern.
I'm Melissa Axelberth with a quote from the news. It's not really about me. I think it's about the power of the state. That was Chinese rebel artist Ai Weiwei on the release of his new heavy metal music video that features reenactments of his time in prison on tax charges and fantasies of what he imagined his guards were thinking. Now this.
In my own little corner, in my own little chair, I can be whatever I want to be. On the wing of my fancy, I can fly anywhere, and the world will open its arms to me.
Laura Osnes from the new Ghostlight Records CD of Rodgers and Hammerstein's Cinderella. How appropriate that in an age of makeovers for performers, politicians, even corporations, the ultimate makeover show, after another makeover of its own, is up for 9 prestigious Tony Awards next month, including Best Revival of a Musical, though in fact the show was never actually on Broadway before.
Originally written for television by the same genius pair that produced Oklahoma, Carousel, The King and I, and The Sound of Music, Cinderella the Musical first starred Julie Andrews in 1957, Leslie Ann Warren in 1965, Brandy and Whitney Houston in 1997. The latest production, with a politically correct new book by Douglas Carter Bean of Sister Act and Xanadu, in addition to Osnes, stars Santino Fontana as her prince and Victoria Clark as the fairy godmother. Now, with an inside view of how the magical musical was kept true to its roots, yet new for contemporary sensibilities, for your ears only, we're joined by Ted Chapin, president and executive director of the Rodgers and Hammerstein Organization. Welcome to our show.
It's my honor to be here.
After all their success with big Broadway shows and their extravaganza Hollywood versions, what prompted Rodgers and Hammerstein to write Cinderella for TV? Just money, the lure of new technology, their biggest one-night audience ever?
The simple answer is they were asked. CBS did not want to be one-upped by NBC's huge success with Peter Pan that they had showed several times in the 50s with great success. And I think CBS's notion was, how can we do better than that? Let's hire the kings of Broadway. Let's commission them to write a brand new musical for television. We'll air it live and we'll promote the hell out of it, which they did. I mean, I love that era where Pepsi-Cola was one of the sponsors. So for several months before the airing, there were Cinderella storybooks in 6-packs of Pepsi across the country.
Do we know how the pair reacted to seeing their work on a little screen?
I think they, it was a fascinating experience for them. I think when you look at what the 1957 live telecast sounds like and looks like, they rose to the challenge in that they knew how to write good songs for theater situations. They were fascinated. The opening song, for example, The Prince is Giving a Ball, in the original, it's all quick cutaways. It's different solo people saying, I wish I were an older girl, I wish I were a younger girl, different things that have proven to be challenging when people have put Cinderella on the stage, like that.
After the TV debut, Cinderella became a theater staple around the country. Why was it never expanded for Broadway before?
Well, interesting. In the Variety, the week after the telecast in 1957, Hammerstein announced that they were going to be doing it for Broadway, probably and ready for the spring 1958 season. Tommy Steele did a production in London where he starred in it as Buttons, that great character we all know from Cinderella. And that is very odd, actually. I mean, it's sort of a half panto, the British pantomime that they love. My suspicion is that something about Tommy Steele doing it in London made Rodgers and Hammerstein not quite as interesting. Also, you know, they were prodigious writers. I mean, they wrote 9 musicals for Broadway in 16 years. And shortly after Cinderella, they wrote Flower Drum Song. And shortly after that, they wrote The Sound of Music. And then Hammerstein died. So there wasn't a lot of time to do it, I think.
Because a Broadway musical is significantly longer than a TV show. Talk about the way the R&H archives were scoured for additional songs.
Well, when Douglas Carter Bean came in here and basically said, you know, he gave told me some of the ideas he had for this Cinderella. He then said, so what's in the trunk? You know, and so my wonderful director of music here, Bruce Pomahack, and I took him through the few songs that are in the trunk. And he was really quite smart at saying, no, that one won't work. Oh, what about that? That would be interesting. And because he was fashioning a new libretto, he was able to write around the songs that he found so that, for example, the first song that the prince sings called Me, Who Am I, which is a song about a slightly doubting young man. It turns out that was cut from Me and Juliet. I don't know who that man was there, but it was appropriate to the prince and I think helped Douglas focus his prince in a more interesting way to a modern audience.
And some of the songs were actually cut from an original version of Cinderella for TV. Tell me, which of the R&H show has proved over the years the most popular or the biggest moneymaker?
Well, both are the bookends. Oklahoma and The Sound of Music are the ones that are the most popular and are the most financially viable. And in a funny way, depending on slight trends, they kind of change position. Some years it'll be Oklahoma, some years it'll be The Sound of Music, but it's pretty clearly those two.
And have you got a personal favorite?
Well, I love The King and I, but that's I don't know why, but there's something about The King and I that I find kind of wonderful.
And I must say, I think the overture to South Pacific, speaking not of the whole show, but just of overtures, has to be the most thrilling overture I've ever heard in the theater.
Well, The King and I ain't too bad, but it's what's really fascinating about those overtures is how in an era where the overtures started about 8 minutes before the printed curtain time, they were clearly, 5 minutes of music, not necessarily geared for an audience to be quiet and listen to, but to shut them up in order to make them quiet to take on the play.
Ted Chapin is president and executive director of the Rodgers and Hammerstein Organization.
I may never come down to earth again.
Cinderella and Her Prince. And this has been For Your Ears Only. For Your Ears Only on Air is also online at iTunes, YouTube, FeedBurner.com, and the Stitcher.com app for mobile devices. But to continue, we really need your tax-deductible donation. Please pledge to DavidEarsOnly at gmail.com.
This broadcast was engineered by Chad Dugatz at the Hangar Studio Play It Productions with intern Laura Engstrom. I'm Melissa Exelberg.
Our show is a nonprofit project of the New York Foundation for the Arts with support from the GateWave.org radio reading service for those with disabilities and award-winning ACAM Associates. Exceptional management, impeccable reputation for New York co-ops, condos, and condops since 1983. Learn more at ACAM.com. I'm David Alpern.
Now we're back with another archive segment, a major story on our show a year ago.
This week last year, we looked at and beyond the resignation of a controversial head of the U.S. Nuclear Regulatory Commission from our May 27, 2012 broadcast, hosted by Melissa and me.
The task force calls on the commission to redefine adequate protection in light of what we've learned from Fukushima.
I have indicated to Mr. Daley in that letter that I was sorry for the distraction that this has caused.
Last summer, the chairman of the U.S. Nuclear Regulatory Commission, Gregory Yatsko, was all about defending Americans from a nuclear accident like that which followed the giant earthquake and tsunami that struck Japan. By the end of the year, Yatsko was defending himself from allegations by fellow commissioners and staffers that his leadership style was abusive and high-handed. And last week, he announced his resignation, with the Obama administration quickly announcing it would nominate environmental science professor Allison McFarlane, a nuclear waste expert, to replace him.
As Yatsko gave up his position, Japan was giving up nuclear power altogether, joining a number of countries now opting for safer renewable energy. At the same time, a preliminary estimate from the World Health Organization found the accident of Fukushima did not increase the risk of cancer, except for some infants in a nearby town exposed to radioactive iodine. Other experts are calling that a comforting delusion. For one view of the NRC shakeup and the lessons learned from Fukushima, or not, For Your Ears Only, we're joined again by prize-winning investigative reporter, journalism professor, author, and nuclear critic Carl Grossman. Welcome back to the program.
A pleasure, David.
First, let's talk about Yatsko's resignation. During his tenure, he pushed to address safety problems at nuclear plants and got pushback from other commissioners of both parties. What was their rationale?
Well, this is not an anti-nuclear fellow. This is a guy with a Ph.D. in physics. As Christopher Payne of the Natural Resources Defense Council said, Greg's not anti-nuclear, but he's pro-nuclear in a smart and considered way. What the nuclear industry wants are people who are not particularly smart and considered in terms of nuclear technology. They want puppets. Yatsko was not a puppet, and he ended up being pushed out as chairman of the NRC.
What do we know about the style and standards of Professor McFarlane, who's going to be nominated to replace him?
Well, the issue with the NRC sort of goes beyond individuals, unfortunately. I mean, she's an associate professor, and she's been very interested in nuclear waste. But you have to go back and look at the culture of the NRC. We used to have the Atomic Energy Commission, was disbanded in 1974 because it had conflicting missions to both promote and regulate nuclear technology, nuclear power. It was replaced by the NRC, the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, and later, given the promotional role, ostensibly, for nuclear power, was the Department of Energy. The Atomic Energy Commission and the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, throughout all the decades, both never denied a construction or operating license for any nuclear power plant anywhere, anytime in the U.S. It really should be called the Nuclear Rubber Stamp Commission, NR for Rubber Stamp Commission. It's just a lapdog for the nuclear industry, and anyone who doesn't fall in line, like Yatsko, ends up being pushed out.
What changes in nuclear regulation or operation actually were adopted in the U.S. after Fukushima, and what are the most important lessons that have not been implemented?
In fact, we've been going backwards. Other countries have been going forward. Germany, for example, because of Fukushima, has decided to shut down all its 23 nuclear power plants and develop safe, clean, renewable energy technologies, solar and wind and so forth. We have gone absolutely the other way. For example, on June 7th, we're just talking about in a few days, the Nuclear Regulatory Commission is sponsoring a conference to discuss its consideration of allowing nuclear power plants in the U.S. to go for 80 years. Originally, they were only conceived for 40 years because after 40 years, metals become so embrittled, you have a safety issue. In recent years, nevertheless, the NRC has allowed more than half the nuclear, 104 nuclear plants in the U.S., the NRC, and this has been going on since Fukushima as well, has allowed 73 nuclear plants to keep operating for 60 years. As I note, in just a few days, it's going to have this conference on letting them go 80 years. Imagine having an 80-year-old car and taking it on the interstate highway or any highway. How confident would you be in the reliability of that automobile? The NRC, the Department of Energy, the Obama administration overall, because it's been pushing this is post-Fukushima, the licensing of new nuclear power plants has been going backwards. I mean, this was one of the big problems with the nuclear industry and the nuclear establishment in government and Yatsko. For example, this is back in February, the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, in a 4-1 vote, gave the go-ahead for two new nuclear plants to be built down in Georgia, the Vogtle nuclear plants. And Yatsko said, "I cannot support issuing this license as if Fukushima has never happened." And he called for lessons learned about Fukushima to be adopted in terms of the NRC's position on licensing. They have not. the NRC has been going backwards. They are of the opinion that Fukushima is not the catastrophe that it is, and we just have to keep promoting, pushing nuclear power.
Carl Grossman is a prize-winning investigative reporter, a journalism professor at the State University of New York, and the author of many books, including Cover Up, What You Are Not Supposed to Know About Nuclear Power. Follow him at carlgrossman.com.
Resignation fallout from our May 27, 2012 broadcast. Last month, former NRC Commissioner Gregory Yatsko was appointed to the little-known Congressional Advisory Panel of the National Nuclear Security Administration, just days after he declared that all 104 U.S. nuclear power reactors have a safety problem that cannot be fixed and should be replaced with newer, smaller technology. More than 2,000 safe energy organizations have supported his call in petitions to the NRC, though industry supporters still fault his analysis.
In Japan last week, the nation's nuclear watchdog agency endorsed the finding by a panel of seismologists that a nuclear plant at Suruga was located over an active fault line, thus vulnerable to significant damage in an earthquake and not qualified for testing required to return to operation. Five other reactors are suspected of sitting dangerously on similar faults. I'm Melissa Axelberth.
I'm David Alpern. We'll visit the archive again next week.
Now, more from the stars of Rodgers and Hammerstein's Cinderella on Broadway.
I looked up when you came through the door. My head started reeling. You gave me the feeling the room had no ceiling or floor. 10 minutes ago, I met you, and we murmured our how do you do's. I wanted to ring out the bells and fling out my arms and to sing out the news. I have found her. She's an angel with the dust of the stars in her eyes. We are dancing, we are flying, and she's taking me back to the sky. In the arms of my love, I'm flying over mountain and meadow and glen. And I like it so well that for all I can tell, I may never come down again. I may never come down to earth again.
10 minutes ago, I met you, and we murmured our how do you do's. I wanted to ring out the bells and fling out my arms and to sing out the news. I have found him, I have found him. It's so